on their own, an experiment abandoned. I theorize about the origins of Gathenian sexual physiology. What do I actually know about it? Otya Nim's communication from the Orgorain region has cleared up some of my earlier misconceptions. Let me set down all I know, and after that my theories. First things first. The sexual cycle averages 26 to 28 days. They tend to speak of it as 26 days, approximating it to the lunar cycle. For 21 or 22 days, the individual is somer, sexually inactive, latent. On about the 18th day, hormonal changes are initiated by the pituitary control, and on the 22nd or 23rd day, the individual enters kemer, estrus. In this first phase of kemer, Karheidisch Secher, he remains completely androgynous. Gender and potency are not attained in isolation. A Gathenian in first phase kemer, if kept alone or with others not in kemer, remains incapable of coitus. Yet the sexual impulse is tremendously strong in this phase, controlling the entire personality, subjecting all other drives to its imperative. When the individual finds a partner in kemer, hormonal secretion is further stimulated, most importantly by touch, secretion, scent, until in one partner either a male or female hormonal dominance is established. The genitals engorge or shrink accordingly, foreplay intensifies, and the partner, triggered by the change, takes on the other sexual role. Without exception? If there are exceptions resulting in kemer partners of the same sex, they are so rare as to be ignored. The second phase of kemer, Karheidisch Thorharmon, the mutual process of establishing sexuality and potency, apparently occurs within a time span of 2 to 20 hours. If one of the partners is already in full kemer, the phase for the newer partner is liable to be quite short. If the two are entering kemer together, it is likely to take longer. Normal individuals have no predisposition to either sexual role in kemer. They do not know whether they will be the male or the female, and have no choice in the matter. Otya Nim wrote that in the Orgorain region, the use of hormone derivatives to establish a preferred sexuality is quite common. I haven't seen this done in rural Karheid. Once the sex is determined, it cannot change during the kemer period. The culminant phase of kemer, Karheidisch Thokemer, lasts from 2 to 5 days, during which sexual drive and capacity are at maximum. It ends fairly abruptly, and if conception has not taken place, the individual returns to the somer phase within a few hours. Note, Otya Nim thinks this fourth phase is the equivalent of the menstrual cycle. And the cycle begins anew. If the individual was in the female role and was impregnated, hormonal activity, of course, continues, and for the 8.4-month gestation period and the 6 to 8-month lactation period, this individual remains female. The male sexual organs remain retracted, as they are in somer, the breasts enlarge somewhat, and the pelvic girdle widens. With the cessation of lactation, the female re-enters somer and becomes once more a perfect androgyne. No physiological habit is established, and the mother of several children may be the father of several more. Social observations. Very superficial as yet. I've been moving about too much to make coherent social observations. Kemer is not always played by pairs. Pairing seems to be the commonest custom, but in the kemer houses of towns and cities, groups may form and intercourse take place promiscuously among the males and females of the group. The furthest extreme from this practice is the custom of vowing kemering, Karheidisch Oskjomer, which is to all intents and purposes monogamous marriage. It has no legal status, but socially and ethically is an ancient and vigorous institution. The whole structure of the Karheidisch clan hearths and domains is indubitably based upon the institution of monogamous marriage. I am not sure of divorce rules in general. Here in Asnorinner there is divorce, but no remarriage after either divorce or the partner's death. One can only vow kemering once. Descent, of course, is reckoned, all over Gethin, from the mother, the parent in the flesh, Karheidisch Amma. Incest is permitted, with various restrictions, between siblings, even the full siblings of a vowed Kemmering pair. Siblings are not, however, allowed to vow Kemmering, nor keep Kemmering after the birth of a child to one of the pair. Incest between generations is strictly forbidden, in Karhide Ogorain, but is said to be permitted among the tribesmen of Perunta, the Antarctic continent. This may be slander. What else have I learned for certain? That seems to sum it up. There is one feature of this anomalous arrangement that might have adaptive value. Since coitus takes place only during the period of fertility, the chance of conception is high, as with all mammals that have an estrous cycle. In harsh conditions, where infant mortality is great, a race survival value may be indicated. At present, neither infant mortality nor the birth rate runs high in the civilized areas of Geten. Tinnebossel estimates a population of not over 100 million on the three continents, and considers it to have been stable for at least a millennium. Ritual and ethical abstention and the use of contraceptive drugs seem to have played the major part in maintaining this stability. There are aspects of ambisexuality that we have only glimpsed or guessed at, and which we may never grasp entirely. The Kemmer phenomenon fascinates all of us investigators, of course. It fascinates us, but it rules the Gethenians, dominates them. The structure of their societies, the management of their industry, agriculture, commerce, the size of their settlements, the subjects of their stories, everything is shaped to fit the Sommer-Kemmer cycle. Everybody has his holiday once a month. No one, whatever his position, is obliged or forced to work when in Kemmer. No one is barred from the Kemmer house, however poor or strange. Everything gives way before the recurring torment and festivity of passion. This is easy for us to understand. What is very hard for us to understand is that 4/5 of the time these people are not sexually motivated at all. Room is made for sex, plenty of room, but a room, as it were, apart. The society of Gethen, in its daily functioning and in its continuity, is without sex. Consider, anyone can turn his hand to anything. This sounds very simple, but its psychological effects are incalculable. The fact that everyone between 17 and 35 or so is liable to be, as Nim put it, tied down to childbearing, implies that no one is quite so thoroughly tied down here as women elsewhere are likely to be, psychologically or physically. Burden and privilege are shared out pretty equally. Everybody has the same risk to run or choice to make. Therefore, nobody here is quite so free as a free male anywhere else. Consider, a child has no psychosexual relationship to his mother and father. There is no myth of Oedipus on winter. Consider, there is no unconsenting sex, no rape. As with most mammals other than man, coitus can be performed only by mutual invitation and consent. Otherwise, it is not possible. Seduction certainly is possible, but it must have to be awfully well-timed. Consider, there is no division of humanity into strong and weak halves. Protective, protected, dominant, submissive, owner, chattel, active, passive. In fact, the whole tendency to dualism that pervades human thinking may be found to be lessened or changed on winter. The following must go into my finished directives. When you meet a Gethenian, you cannot and must not do what a bisexual naturally does, which is to cast him in the role of man or woman, while adopting towards him a corresponding role dependent on your expectations of the patterned or possible interactions between persons of the same or the opposite sex. Our entire pattern of sociosexual interaction is non-existent here. They cannot play the game. They do not see one another as men or women. This is almost impossible for our imagination to accept. What is the first question we ask about a newborn baby? Yet you cannot think of a Gethenian as it. They are not neuters, they are potentials or integrals. Lacking the Karhidish human pronoun used for persons in Sommer, I must say he, for the same reasons as we used the masculine pronoun in referring to a transcendent god. It is less defined, less specific, than the neuter or the feminine. But the very use of the pronoun in my thoughts leads me continually to forget that the Karheiter I am with is not a man, but a man-woman. The first mobile, if one is sent, must be warned that, unless he is very self-assured, or senile, his pride will suffer. A man wants his virility regarded. A woman wants her femininity appreciated, however indirect and subtle the indications of regard and appreciation. On winter they will not exist. One is respected and judged only as a human being. It is an appalling experience. Back to my theory. Contemplating the motives for such an experiment, if such it was, and trying perhaps to exculpate our heinous ancestors from the guilt of barbarism, of treating lives as things, I have made some guesses as to what they might have been after. The Sommer-Kemmer cycle strikes us as degrading, a return to the estrus cycle of the lower mammals, a subjection of human beings to the mechanical imperative of rut. It is possible that the experimenters wished to see whether human beings lacking continuous sexual potentiality would remain intelligent and capable of culture. On the other hand, the limitation of the sexual drive to a discontinuous time segment and the equalizing of it in androgyny must prevent, to a large extent, both the exploitation and frustration of the drive. There must be sexual frustration, though society provides as well as it can against it, so long as the social unit is large enough that more than one person will be in Kemmer at one time, sexual fulfillment is fairly certain. But at least it cannot build up. It is over when Kemmer is over. Fine, thus they are spared much waste and madness. But what is left in Sommer? What is there to sublimate? What would a society of eunuchs achieve? But of course, they are not eunuchs in Sommer, but rather more comparable to pre-adolescence. Not castrate, but latent. Another guess concerning the hypothetical experiment object: the elimination of war. Did the ancient Hainish postulate that continuous sexual capacity and organized social aggression, neither of which are attributes of any mammal but man, are cause and effect? Or, like Thomas Song Angot, did they consider war to be a purely masculine displacement activity, a vast rape, and therefore, in their experiment, eliminate the masculinity that rapes and the femininity that is raped? God knows. The fact is that Gathenians, though highly competitive, as proved by the elaborate social channels provided for competition, for prestige, etc., seem not to be very aggressive. At least, they apparently have never yet had what one could call a war. They kill one another readily by ones and twos, seldom by tens or twenties, never by hundreds or thousands. Why? It may turn out to have nothing to do with their androgyne psychology. There are not very many of them, after all. And there is the climate. The weather of winter is so relentless, so near the limit of tolerability, even to them with all their cold adaptations, that perhaps they use up their fighting spirit fighting the cold. The marginal peoples, the races that just get by, are rarely the warriors. And in the end, the dominant factor in Gathenian life is not sex or any other human thing, it is their environment, their cold world. Here man has a crueler enemy, even than himself. I am a woman of peaceful Chippewar, and no expert on the attractions of violence or the nature of war. Someone else will have to think this out. But I really don't see how anyone could put much stock in victory or glory after he had spent a winter on winter and seen the face of the ice. Chapter 8. Another Way into Orgorain. I spent the summer more as an investigator than a mobile, going about the land of Karheid from town to town, from domain to domain, watching and listening, things a mobile cannot do at first, while he is still a marvel and monstrosity, and must be forever on show and ready to perform. I would tell my hosts in those rural hearths and villages who I was, Most of them had heard a little about me over the radio, and had a vague idea what I was. They were curious, some more, some less. Few were frightened of me personally, or showed the xenophobic revulsion. An enemy in Karhide is not a stranger. An invader, the stranger who comes unknown, is a guest. Your enemy is your neighbor. During the month of Kus, I lived on the eastern coast in a clan hearth called Gorinhering, a house-town fort farm built up on a hill above the eternal fogs of the Hodamin Ocean. Some 500 people lived there. 4,000 years ago, I should have found their ancestors living in the same place, in the same kind of house. Along in those 4 millennia, the electric engine was developed, radios and power loom and power vehicles and farm machinery and all the rest began to be used, and a machine age got going gradually without any industrial revolution, without any revolution at all. Winter hasn't achieved in 30 centuries what Terra once achieved in 30 decades. Neither has winter ever paid the price that Terra paid. Winter is an inimical world. Its punishment for doing things wrong is sure and prompt. Death from cold or death from hunger. No margin, no reprieve. A man can trust his luck, but a society can't. And cultural change, like random mutation, may make things chancier. So they have gone very slowly. At any one point in their history, a hasty observer would say that all technological progress and diffusion had ceased. Yet it never has. Compare the torrent and the glacier. Both get where they are going. I talked a lot with the old people of Gorinhering, and also with the children. It was my first chance to see much of Gathenian children, for in Erhenrang they are all in the private or public hearths and schools. A quarter to a third of the adult urban population is engaged full-time in the nurture and education of the children. Here the clan looked after its own. Nobody and everybody was responsible for them. They were a wild lot, chasing about over those fog-hidden hills and beaches. When I could round one up long enough to talk, I found them shy, proud, and immensely trustful. The parental instinct varies as widely on Gethen as anywhere. One can't generalize. I never saw a Karhider hit a child. I've seen one speak very angrily to a child. Their tenderness towards their children struck me as being profound, effective, and almost wholly unpossessive. Only in that unpossessiveness does it perhaps differ from what we call the maternal instinct. I suspect that the distinction between a maternal and a paternal instinct is scarcely worth making. The parental instinct, the wish to protect, to further, is not a sex-linked characteristic. Early in Hakana, we heard in Gorinhering on the static-fuzzed palace bulletin that King Argaven had announced his expectation of an heir. Not another Kemmering son, of which he already had 7, but an heir of the body, king's son. The king was pregnant. I found this funny, and so did the clansmen of Gorinhering, but for different reasons. They said he was too old to be bearing children, and they got hilarious and obscene on the subject. The old men went about cackling over it for days. They laughed at the king, but were not otherwise much interested in him. "The domains are Karhide," Estraven had said. And like so much, Estraven had said, it kept recurring to me as I learned more. The seeming nation, unified for centuries, was a stew of uncoordinated principalities, towns, villages, pseudo-feudal tribal economic units, a sprawl and splatter of vigorous, competent, quarrelsome individualities over which a grid of authority was insecurely and lightly laid. Nothing, I thought, could ever unite Karhide as a nation. Total diffusion of rapid communication devices, which is supposed to bring about nationalism almost inevitably, had not done so. The Ecumen could not appeal to these people as a social unit, a mobilizable entity. Rather, it must speak to their strong, though undeveloped, sense of humanity, of human unity. I got quite excited thinking about this. I was, of course, wrong. Yet I had learned something about Gathenians, which in the long run proved to be useful knowledge. Unless I was to spend all year in Old Karhide, I must return to the Westfall before the passes of the Kargav closed. Even here on the coast, There had been 2 light snowfalls in the last month of summer. Rather reluctantly I set off west again and came to Erinrang early in Gore, the first month of autumn. Argivan was now in seclusion in the summer palace at Warriver, and had named Pemer Har Drem Ir Taib as regent during his confinement. Taib was already making the most of his term of power. Within a couple of hours of my arrival, I began to see the flaw in my analysis of Karhide. It was already out of date, and also began to feel uncomfortable, perhaps unsafe, in Erinrang. Argivan was not sane. The sinister incoherence of his mind darkened the mood of his capital. He fed on fear. All the good of his reign had been done by his ministers and the Kyurimi. But he had not done much harm. His wrestles with his own nightmares had not damaged the kingdom. His cousin Taib was another kind of fish. For his insanity had logic. Taib knew when to act and how to act. Only he did not know when to stop. Taib spoke on the radio a good deal. Estrafan, when in power, had never done so. And it was not in the Karhidish vein. Their government was not a public performance, normally. It was covert and indirect. Taib, however, orated. Hearing his voice on the air, I saw again the long-toothed smile and the face masked with a net of fine wrinkles. His speeches were long and loud. Praises of Karhide, disparagements of Orgorain, vilifications of disloyal factions, discussions of the integrity of the kingdom's borders, lectures in history and ethics and economics, all in a ranting, canting, emotional tone that went shrill with vituperation or adulation. He talked much about pride of country and love of the parent land, but little about Shiv-Grethor, personal pride or prestige. Had Karhide lost so much prestige in the Sinoth Valley business that the subject could not be brought up? No, for he often talked about the Sinoth Valley. I decided that he was deliberately avoiding talk of Shiv-Grethor because he wished to rouse emotions of a more elemental, uncontrollable kind. He wanted to stir up something that the whole Shiv-Grethor pattern was a refinement upon, a sublimation of. He wanted his hearers to be frightened and angry. His themes were not pride and love at all, though he used the words perpetually. As he used them, they meant self-praise and hate. He talked a great deal about truth also, for he was, he said, cutting down beneath the veneer of civilization. It is a durable, ubiquitous, specious metaphor, that one about veneer, or paint, or plyofilm, or whatever, hiding the noble reality beneath. It can conceal a dozen fallacies at once. One of the most dangerous is the implication that civilization, being artificial, is unnatural, that it is the opposite of primitiveness. Of course, there is no veneer. The process is one of growth, and primitiveness and civilization are degrees of the same thing. If civilization has an opposite, it is war. Of those two things, you have either one or the other, not both. It seemed to me as I listened to Taib's dull, fierce speeches that what he sought to do by fear and by persuasion was to force his people to change a choice they had made before their history began, the choice between those opposites. The time was ripe, perhaps. Slow as their material and technological advance had been, little as they valued progress in itself, they had finally, in the last 5 or 10 or 15 centuries, got a little ahead of nature. They weren't absolutely at the mercy of their merciless climate any longer. A bad harvest would not starve a whole province, or a bad winter isolate every city. On this basis of material stability, Orgorain had gradually built up a unified and increasingly efficient centralized state. Now Karhide was to pull herself together and do the same. And the way to make her do it was not by sparking her pride, or building up her trade, or improving her roads, farms, colleges, and so on. None of that. That's all civilization, veneer. And Taib dismissed it with scorn. He was after something sure, the sure, quick, and lasting way to make people into a nation. War. His ideas concerning it could not have been too precise, but they were quite sound. The only other means of mobilizing people rapidly and entirely is with a new religion. None was handy. He would make do with war. I sent the regent a note in which I quoted to him the question I had put to the foretellers of Otherhold, and the answer I had got. Tybe made no response. I then went to the Orgota embassy and requested permission to enter Orgorain. There are fewer people running the offices of the stables of the Ecumen Hinhain than there were running that embassy of one small country to another, and all of them were armed with yards of sound tapes and records. They were slow, they were thorough, none of the slapdash arrogance and sudden deviousness that marked Karhaitish officialdom. I waited while they filled out their forms. The waiting got rather uneasy. The number of palace guards and city police in the streets of Erinrang seemed to multiply every day. They were armed, and they were even developing a sort of uniform. The mood of the city was bleak, although business was good, prosperity general, and the weather fair. Nobody wanted much to do with me. My landlady no longer showed people my room, but rather complained about being badgered by people from the palace, and treated me less as an honored sideshow than as a political suspect. Tybe made a speech about a foray in the Sinoth Valley. Brave Karhaitish farmers, true patriots, had dashed across the border south of Sassanoth, had attacked an Orgota village, burned it, and killed 9 villagers, and then, dragging the bodies back, had dumped them into the A River. "Such a grave," said the regent, "as all the enemies of our nation will find." I heard this broadcast in the eating hall of my island. Some people looked grim as they listened, others uninterested, others satisfied, but in these various expressions there was one common element, a little tick or facial cramp that had not used to be there, a look of anxiety. That evening a man came to my room, my first visitor since I had returned to Erinrang. He was slight, smooth-skinned, shy-mannered, and wore the gold chain of a foreteller, one of the celibates. "I'm a friend of one who befriended you," he said with the brusqueness of the timid. "I've come to ask you a favor for his sake."
"You mean Faxa?"
"No, Estraven."
My helpful expression must have changed.
There was a little pause, after which the stranger said, "Estraven, the traitor. You remember him, perhaps?"
Anger had displaced timidity, and he was going to play Shifgretho with me. If I wanted to play, my move was to say something like, "I'm not sure, tell me something about him." But I didn't want to play, and was used to volcanic Karhaitish tempers by now. I faced his anger deprecatingly and said, "Of course I do. But not with friendship." His dark, down-slanted eyes were direct and keen. "Well, rather with gratitude and disappointment."
"Did he send you to me?"
"He did not."
I waited for him to explain himself. He said,
"Excuse me. I presumed. I accept what presumption has earned me."
I stopped the stiff little fellow as he made for the door. "Please. I don't know who you are or what you want. I haven't refused, I simply haven't consented. You must allow me the right to a reasonable caution. Estraven was exiled for supporting my mission here.
Do you consider yourself to be in his debt for that?"
"Well, in a sense. However, the mission I am on overrides all personal debts and loyalties."
"If so," said the stranger with fierce certainty, "it is an immoral mission."
That stopped me. He sounded like an advocate of the Ecumen, and I had no answer. "I don't think it is," I said finally. "The shortcomings are in the messenger, not the message. But please tell me what it is you want me to do."
"I have certain monies, rents and debts, which I was able to collect from the wreck of my friend's fortune. Hearing that you are about to go to Orgorain, I thought to ask you to take the money to him if you find him. As you know, it would be a punishable offense to do so. It may also be useless. He may be in Mishnori, or on one of their damnable farms, or dead. I have no way of finding out. I have no friends in Orgorain, and none here I dared ask this of. I thought of you as one above politics, free to come and go. I did not stop to think that you have, of course, your own politics. I apologize for my stupidity."
"Well, I'll take the money for him. But if he's dead or can't be found, to whom shall I return it?" He stared at me. His face worked and changed, and he caught his breath in a sob.
Most Karhiders cry easily, being no more ashamed of tears than of laughter. He said, "Thank you. My name is Forreth. I'm an indweller at Orgni Fastness."
"You're of Estrefen's clan?"
"No. Forreth Remir Osboth. I was his Kimmering."
Estrefen had had no Kimmering when I knew him. But I could rouse no suspicion of this fellow in myself. He might be unwittingly serving someone else's purpose, but he was genuine. And he had just taught me a lesson, that Shif Grethor can be played on the level of ethics, and that the expert player will win. He had cornered me in about 2 moves. He had the money with him and gave it to me, a solid sum in Royal Karhaitish merchant's notes of credit, nothing to incriminate me, and consequently nothing to prevent me from simply spending it.
"If you find him..." He stuck.
"A message?"
"No. Only if I knew..."
"If I do find him, I'll try to send news of him to you."
"Thank you," he said.
And he held out both his hands to me, a gesture of friendship that in Karhide is not lightly made.
"I wish success to your mission, Mr. I. He, Estrefen, he believed you came here to do good, I know. He believed it very strongly."
There was nothing in the world for this man outside Estrefen. He was one of those who are damned to love once. I said again, "Is there no word from you that I might take him?"
"To tell him the children are well," he said,
then hesitated and said quietly,
"Nuthuth, no matter,"
and left me. 2 days later I took the road out of Ehinrang, the northwest road this time, afoot. My permission to enter Orgorain had arrived much sooner than the clerks and officials of the Orgota embassy had led me to expect, or had themselves expected. When I went to get the papers, they treated me with a sort of poisonous respect, resentful that protocol and regulations had, on somebody's authority, been pushed aside for me. As Karhide had no regulations at all about leaving the country, I set straight off. Over the summer I had learned what a pleasant land Karhide was for walking in. Roads and inns are set for foot traffic as well as for powered vehicles, and where inns are wanting one may count infallibly on the code of hospitality. Townsfolk of co-domains and the villagers, farmers or lord of any domain, will give a traveller food and lodging for 3 days by the code, and in practice for much longer than that. And what's best is that you are always received without fuss, welcomed as if they had been expecting you to come. I meandered across the splendid slanting land between the Cess and the A, taking my time, working out my keep a couple of mornings in the fields of the great domains, where they were getting the harvest in, every hand and tool and machine at work to get the golden fields cut before the weather turned. It was all golden, all benign, that week of walking. And at night, before I slept, I would step out of the dark farmhouse or firelit hearth hall where I was lodged, and walk away into the dry stubble to look up at the stars, flaring like far cities in the windy autumn dark. In fact, I was reluctant to leave this land, which I had found, though so indifferent to the envoy, so gentle to the stranger. I dreaded starting all over, trying to repeat my news in a new language to new hearers, failing again, perhaps. I wandered more north than west, justifying my course by a curiosity to see the Sinnoth Valley region, the locus of the rivalry between Karhide and Orgorain. Though the weather held clear, it began to grow colder, and at last I turned west before I got to Sassanoth, remembering that there was a fence across that stretch of border, and I might not be so easily let out of Karhide there. Here the border was the A, a narrow river, but fierce, glacier-fed like all rivers of the great continent. I doubled back a few miles south to find a bridge, and came on one linking 2 little villages, Passerer on the Karhide side and Siwensen in Orgorain, staring sleepily at each other across the noisy A. The Karhidish bridge-keeper asked me only if I planned to return that night, and waved me on across. On the Orgota side, an inspector was called out to inspect my passport and papers, which he did for about an hour, a Karhidish hour at that. He kept the passport,
telling me I must call for it next morning, and gave me in place of it a permiso for meals and lodging at the commensal transient house of Siewensen. I spent another hour in the office of the superintendent of the transient house. While the superintendent read my papers and checked on the authenticity of my permiso, by telephoning the inspector at the commensal border station from which I had just come. I can't properly define that Orgota word, here translated as commensal, commensality. Its root is a word meaning to eat together. Its usage includes all national governmental institutions of Orgarine, from the state as a whole, through its 33 component substates or districts, to the sub-substates, townships, communal farms, mines, factories, and so on, that compose these. As an adjective, it is applied to all the above. In the form, the commensals, it usually means the 33 heads of districts, who form the governing body, executive and legislative, of the great commensality of Orgarine. But it may also mean the citizens, the people themselves. In this curious lack of distinction between the general and specific applications of the word, in the use of it for both the whole and the part, the state and the individual, in this imprecision is its precisest meaning. My papers and my presence were at last approved, and by fourth hour I got my first meal since early breakfast, supper. Kadik porridge and cold sliced bread apple. For all its array of officials, Siewensen was a very small, plain place, sunk deep in rural torpor. The commensal transient house was shorter than its name. Its dining room had one table, five chairs, and no fire. Food was brought in from the village hot shop. The other room was the dormitory, six beds, a lot of dust, a little mildew. I had it to myself. As everybody in Siewensen appeared to have gone to bed directly after supper, I did the same. I fell asleep in that utter country silence that makes your ears ring. I slept an hour and woke in the grip of a nightmare about explosions, invasion, murder, and conflagration. It was a particularly bad dream, the kind in which you run down a strange street in the dark with a lot of people who have no faces, while houses go up in flames behind you and children scream. I ended up in an open field, standing in dry stubble by a black hedge. The dull red half-moon and some stars showed through clouds overhead. The wind was bitter cold. Near me, a big barn or granary bulked up in the dark, and in the distance beyond it I saw little volleys of sparks going up on the wind. I was bare-legged and barefoot, in my shirt, without breeches, heb or coat, but I had my pack. It held not only spare clothes but also my rubies, cash, documents, papers, and ansible, and I slept with it as a pillow when I traveled. Evidently I hung on to it even during bad dreams. I got out shoes and breeches and my fur-lined winter heb, and dressed, there in the cold, dark country silence while Siewensen smoldered half a mile behind me. Then I struck out looking for a road, and soon found one, and on it, other people. They were refugees like me, but they knew where they were going. I followed them, having no direction of my own, except away from Siewensen, which, I gathered as we walked, had been raided by a foray from Passer across the bridge. They had struck, set fire, withdrawn. There had been no fight. But all at once, lights glared down the dark at us, and scuttling to the roadside, we watched a land caravan, 20 trucks come at top speed out of the west towards Siewensen and pass us with a flash of light and a hiss of wheels 20 times repeated. Then silence, and the dark again. We soon came to a communal farm center, where we were halted and interrogated. I tried to attach myself to the group I had followed down the road, but no luck. No luck for them, either, if they did not have their identification papers with them. They, and I as a foreigner without passport, were cut out of the herd and given separate quarters for the night in a storage barn, a vast stone semi-cellar with one door locked on us from outside, and no window. Now and then the door was unlocked, and a new refugee thrust in by a farm policeman armed with the Guthenian sonic gun. The door shut. It was perfectly dark, no light. One's eyes, cheated of sight, sent starbursts and fiery blots whirling through the black.
The air was cold and heavy with the dust and odor of grain. No one had a handlight. These were people who had been routed out of their beds like me. A couple of them were literally naked, and had been given blankets by others on the way. They had nothing. If they had had anything, it would have been their papers. Better to be naked than to lack papers in Orgarain. They sat dispersed in that hollow, huge, dusty blindness. Sometimes two conversed a while, low-voiced. There was no fellow feeling of being prisoners together. There was no complaint. I heard one whisper to my left. I saw him in the street outside my door. His head was blown off.
They use those guns that fire pieces of metal, foray guns.
Tiena said they weren't from Passora, but from Ovord domain, come down by truck. But there isn't any quarrel between Ovord and Siwensin.
They did not understand. They did not complain. They did not protest being locked up in a cellar by their fellow citizens after having been shot and burned out of their homes. They sought no reasons for what had happened to them. The whispers in the dark, random and soft, in the sinuous Orgota language that made Korhidus sound like rocks rattled in a can, ceased little by little. People slept. A baby fretted a while, away off in the dark, crying at the echo of its own cries. The door squealed open, and it was broad day, sunlight like a knife in the eyes, bright and frightening. I stumbled out behind the rest, and was mechanically following them when I heard my name. I had not recognized it. For one thing, the Orgota could say El. Someone had been calling it at intervals ever since the door was unlocked.
"Please come this way, Mr. I,"
said a hurried person in red, and I was no longer a refugee. I was set apart from those nameless ones with whom I had fled down a dark road and whose lack of identity I had shared all night in a dark room. I was named, known, recognized. I existed. It was an intense relief. I followed my leader gladly. The office of the local commensal farm centrality was hectic and upset, but they made time to look after me and apologize to me for the discomforts of the night past.
"If only you had not chosen to enter the commensality at Siwensin," lamented one fat inspector. "If only you had taken the customary roads."
They did not know who I was or why I was to be given particular treatment. Their ignorance was evident, but made no difference. Genli I, the envoy, was to be treated as a distinguished person. He was. By mid-afternoon I was on my way to Mishnori, in a car put at my disposal by the Commensal Farm Centrality of East Homsvashem, District 8. I had a new passport, and a free pass to all transient houses on my road, and a telegraphed invitation to the Mishnori residence of the first Commensal District Commissioner of Entry Roads and Ports, Mr. Uth Shuskis. The radio of the little car came on with the engine and ran while the car did, so all afternoon as I drove through the great level grainlands of East Orgarain, fenceless, for there are no herd beasts, and full of streams, I listened to the radio. It told me about the weather, the crops, road conditions. It cautioned me to drive carefully. It gave me various kinds of news from all 33 districts, the output of various factories, the shipping information from various sea and river ports. It sing-songed some Yomesh chants and then told me about the weather again. It was all very mild, after the ranting I had heard on the radio in Erenrang. No mention was made of the raid on Siwensin. The Orgota government evidently meant to prevent, not rouse, excitement. A brief official bulletin, repeated every so often, said simply that order was being and would be maintained along the eastern border. I liked that. It was reassuring and unprovocative, and had the quiet toughness that I had always admired in Gathenians. Order will be maintained. I was glad now to be out of Korhide, an incoherent land driven towards violence by a paranoid, pregnant king and an egomaniac regent. I was glad to be driving sedately at 25 miles an hour through vast, straight-furrowed grainlands under an even gray sky towards a capital whose government believed in order. The road was posted frequently, unlike the signless Korhidus roads on which you had to ask or guess your way, with directions to prepare to stop at the inspection station of such-and-such commensal area or region. At these internal customs houses, one's identification must be shown and one's passage recorded.
My papers were valid to all examination, and I was politely waved on after minimal delay, and politely advised how far it was to the next transient house if I wanted to eat or sleep. At 25 miles per hour it is a considerable journey from the North Fall to Mishnori, and I spent 2 nights on the way. Food at the transient houses was dull but plentiful, lodging decent, lacking only privacy. Even that was supplied in some measure by the reticence of my fellow travelers. I did not strike up an acquaintance or have a real conversation at any of these halts, though I tried several times. The Ogota seemed not an unfriendly people, but incurious. They were colorless, steady, subdued. I liked them. I had had 2 years of color, choler, and passion in Karhide. A change was welcome. Following the east bank of the great river Kundera, I came on my third morning in Ogorain to Mishnori, the largest city on that world. In the weak sunlight between autumn showers, it was a queer-looking city, all blank stone walls with a few narrow windows set too high, wide streets that dwarfed the crowds, street lamps perched on ridiculous tall posts, roofs pitched steep as praying hands, shed roofs sticking out of house walls 18 feet above ground like big aimless bookshelves, an ill-proportioned, grotesque city in the sunlight. It was not built for sunlight, it was built for winter. In winter, with those streets filled 10 feet up with packed, hard-rolled snow, the steep roofs, icicle-fringed, sleds parked under the shed roofs, narrow window slits shining yellow through driving sleet, you would see the fitness of that city, its economy, its beauty. Mishnori was cleaner, larger, lighter than Erinrang, more open and imposing. Great buildings of yellowish-white stone dominated it, simple, stately blocks all built to a pattern, housing the offices and services of the commensal government, and also the major temples of the Omesh cult, which is promulgated by the commensality. There was no clutter and contortion, no sense of always being under the shadow of something high and gloomy as an Erinrang. Everything was simple, grandly conceived and orderly. I felt as if I had come out of a dark age and wished I had not wasted 2 years in Karhite. This now looked like a country ready to enter the ecumenical age. I drove about the city a while, then returned the car to the proper regional bureau, and went on foot to the residence of the first commensal district commissioner of entry, roads, and ports. I had never made quite sure whether the invitation was a request or a polite command. Nusuf. I was in Ogorain to speak for the ecumen and might as well begin here as anywhere. My notions of Ogota phlegm and self-control were spoiled by Commissioner Shuskis, who advanced on me smiling and shouting, grabbed both my hands in the gesture that Karhaiters reserve for moments of intense personal emotion, pumped my arms up and down as if trying to start a spark in my engine, and bellowed a greeting to the ambassador of the ecumen of the known worlds to Gethin. That was a surprise, for not one of the 12 or 14 inspectors who had studied my papers had shown any sign of recognizing my name or the terms envoy or ecumen, all of which had been at least vaguely familiar to all Karhiders I had met. I had decided that Karhide had never let any broadcasts concerning me be used on Ogota stations, but had tried to keep me a national secret. Not ambassador, Mr. Shuskis. Only an envoy.
Future ambassador, then. Yes, by measure.
Shuskis, a solid, beaming man, looked me up and down and laughed again.
You're not what I expected, Mr. I. Nowhere near it. Tall as a street lamp, they said. Thin as a sledge runner, soot-black and slant-eyed. An ice ogre, I expected. A monster. Nothing of the kind, only you're darker than most of us.
Earth-colored, I said.
And you are in Suensin, the Knight of the Foray? By the breasts of Mesha, what a world we live in! You might have been killed crossing the bridge over the eye, after crossing all space to get here.
Well, well, you're here, and a lot of people want to see you and hear you and make you welcome to Ogorain at last.
He installed me at once, no arguments, in an apartment of his house. A high official and wealthy man, he lived in a style that has no equivalent in Karhide, even among lords of a great domain. Shuskis's house was a whole island, housing over 100 employees,
domestic servants, clerks, technical advisers, and so on, but no relatives, no kinfolk. The system of extended family clans of hearths and domains, though still vaguely discernible in the commensal structure, was nationalized several hundred years ago in Overy. No child over a year old lives with its parent or parents. All are brought up in the commensal hearths. There is no rank by descent. Private wills are not legal. A man dying leaves his fortune to the state. All start equal. But obviously they don't go on so. Tschuskis was rich and liberal with his riches. There were luxuries in my rooms that I had not known existed on winter. For instance, a shower. There was an electric heater as well as a well-stocked fireplace. Tschuskis laughed. They told me, keep the envoy warm, he's from a hot world, an oven of a world, and can't stand our cold. Treat him as if he were pregnant, put furs on his bed, and heaters in his room, heat his wash water, and keep his windows shut. Will it do? Will you be comfortable? Please tell me what else you'd like to have here. Comfortable? Nobody in Karheit had ever asked me under any circumstances if I was comfortable. Mr. Tschuskis, I said with emotion, I feel perfectly at home. He wasn't satisfied till he had got another pestery fur blanket on the bed and more logs into the fireplace. I know how it is, he said. When I was pregnant, I couldn't keep warm. My feet were like ice. I sat over the fire all that winter. Long ago, of course, but I remember. Athenians tend to have their children young. Most of them, after the age of 24 or so, use contraceptives, and they cease to be fertile in the female phase at about 40. Tschuskis was in his 50s, therefore his long ago, of course, and it certainly was difficult to imagine him as a young mother. He was a hard, shrewd, jovial politician, whose acts of kindness served his interest and whose interest was himself. His type is pan-human. I'd met him on Earth, and on Hain, and on Olal. I expect to meet him in Hell. You're well informed as to my looks and tastes, Mr. Tschuskis. I'm flattered. I thought my reputation hadn't preceded me. No, he said, understanding me perfectly. They'd just as soon have kept you buried under a snowdrift there in Erhenrang, eh? But they let you go, they let you go. And that's when we realized here that you weren't just another Karheitish lunatic, but the real thing. I don't follow you, I think. Why, Argiven and his crew were afraid of you, Mr. I. Afraid of you and glad to see your back. Afraid if they mishandled you or silenced you, there might be retribution. A foray from outer space, eh? So they didn't dare touch you, and they tried to hush you up, because they're afraid of you and of what you bring to Gethin. It was exaggerated. I certainly hadn't been censored out of the Karheitish news, at least so long as Estrefan was in power, but I already had the impression that for some reason news hadn't got around about me much in Ogorain, and Tschuskis confirmed my suspicions. Then you aren't afraid of what I bring to Gethin?
No, we are not, sir.
Sometimes I am. He chose to laugh jovially at that. I did not qualify my words. I'm not a salesman. I'm not selling progress to the Abos. We have to meet as equals, with some mutual understanding and candor, before my mission can even begin.
Mr. I, there are a lot of people waiting to meet you, bigwigs and little ones, and some of them are the ones you'll be wanting to talk to here, the people who get things done. I asked for the honor of receiving you because I've got a big house, and because I'm well known as a neutral sort of fellow, not a dominator, and not an open traitor, just a plain commissioner who does his job and won't lay you open to any talk about whose house you're staying in.
He laughed. But that means you'll be eating out a good deal, if you don't mind. I'm at your disposal, Mr. Tschuskis.
Then tonight it'll be a little supper with Vanek Eslose.
Commensal from Kuera. Third district, is it? Of course I had done some homework before I came. He fussed over my condescension in deigning to learn anything about his country. Manners here were certainly different from manners in Karheit. There, the fuss he was making would either have degraded his own Shifgrethor or insulted mine. I wasn't sure which, but it would have done one or the other. Practically everything did. I needed clothes fit for a supper party, having lost my good Erenrang suit in the raid on Siwensen. So that afternoon I took a government taxi downtown and bought myself an Ogota rig. Hieb and shirt were much as in Carhide, but instead of summer breeches, they wore thigh-high leggings the year-round, baggy and cumbrous. The colors were loud, blues or reds, and the cloth and cut and make were all a little shoddy. It was standardized work. The clothes showed me what it was that this impressive, massive city lacked. Elegance. Elegance is a small price to pay for enlightenment, and I was glad to pay it. I went back to Shuskas's house and reveled in the hot shower bath, which came at one from all sides in a kind of prickly mist. I thought of the cold tin tubs of East Carhide that I had chattered and shuddered in last summer, the ice-ringed basin in my Erhenrang room. Was that elegance? Long live comfort! I put on my gaudy red finery and was driven with Shuskas to the supper party in his chauffeured private car. There are more servants, more services in Ogorain than in Carhide. This is because all Orgota are employees of the state. The state must find employment for all citizens, and does so. This, at least, is the accepted explanation, though like most economic explanations, it seems, under certain lights, to omit the main point. Commensal Slosa's fiercely lighted, high white reception room held 20 or 30 guests. Three of them, commensals, and all of them, evidently notables of one kind or another. This was more than a group of Orgota curious to see the alien. I was not a curiosity, as I had been for a whole year in Carhide, not a freak, not a puzzle. I was, it seemed, a key. What door was I to unlock? Some of them had a notion, these statesmen and officials who greeted me effusively, but I had none. I wouldn't find out during supper. All over winter, even in frozen barbarian Perunter, it is considered execrably vulgar to talk business while eating. As supper was served promptly, I postponed my questions and attended to a gummy fish soup and to my host and fellow guests. Slosa was a frail, youngish person with unusually light, bright eyes and a muted, intense voice. He looked like an idealist, a dedicated soul. I liked his manner, but I wondered what it was he was dedicated to. On my left sat another commensal, a fat-faced fellow named Upsle. He was gross, genial, and inquisitive. By the third sip of soup, he was asking me what the devil, was I really born on some other world? What was it like there? Warmer than Gethen? Everybody said. How warm? Well, in this same latitude on Terra, it never snows. It never snows? It never snows? He laughed with real enjoyment, as a child laughs at a good lie, encouraging further flights. Our subarctic regions are rather like your habitable zone. We're farther out of our last ice age than you, but not out, you see. Fundamentally, Terra and Gethen are very much alike. All the inhabited worlds are. Men can live only within a narrow range of environments. Gethen's at one extreme. Then there are worlds hotter than yours? Most of them are warmer. Some are hot. Gde, for instance. It's mostly sand and rock desert. It was warm to start with, and an exploitive civilization wrecked its natural balances 50 or 60,000 years ago, burned up the forests for kindling, as it were. There are still people there, but it resembles, if I understand the text, the Yomesh idea of where thieves go after death. That drew a grin from Opsla, a quiet, approving grin that made me suddenly revise my estimation of the man. Some subcultists hold that those afterlife interims are actually physically situated on other worlds, other planets of the real universe. Have you met with that idea, Mr. I? No, I've been variously described, but nobody's yet explained me away as a ghost. As I spoke, I chanced to look to my right, and saying ghost, saw one. Dark, in dark clothing, still and shadowy, he sat at my elbow, the spectre at the feast. Opsa's attention had been taken up by his other neighbor, and most people were listening to Slosa at the head of the table. I said, in a low voice, I didn't expect to see you here, Lord Estervin. The unexpected is what makes life possible, he said. I was entrusted with a message for you. He looked inquiring. It takes the form of money, some of your own. Foreth Remir Osboth sends it. I have it with me at Mr. Shuskis's house. I'll see that it comes to you. It's kind of you, Mr. I. He was quiet, subdued, reduced.